Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Clint Greenleaf. Clint is the CEO of Content Capital. He is an advisor, a board member, an entrepreneur, and an individual who is passionate about guiding people through the process of sharing great ideas with the world. And today I'm excited to dive into a conversation that goes in many different directions, including lessons he learned the hard way as a 23-year-old CEO, how he's developed the ability to influence both his employees and other CEOs who rely on him for his insight and his expertise. The important concept of addressing people's fears before delivering a message, and also his process for truly connecting with people by discovering their fifth level motivation. Clint is very open about things he's done well, lessons he's learned the hard way, and there are so many things we can learn from listening to this conversation. I'm really excited to share it, and thank you all so much for taking the time to be here today. Of course, before we dive in, I want to take a second to thank our sponsors. First, we have HumanTel. Please head over to humantel.com. That's where you can learn more, read their research, their blogs, dive into their source materials. It's where you can learn more about how to accurately identify what somebody is likely thinking and feeling by evaluating their changing facial expressions and nonverbal behavior. While you're there, enter the code INCLUSIVE25 for 25% off of their best-in-class online training. I've completed it all myself. I highly recommend it. It's over at humantel.com. For the professional interviewers, please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn more about all of the resources they have for interviewers from an educational standpoint, online, in person, national, international, regional, and more. Their interviewer resources, legal resources, support resources, networking resources, so many things that they offer over at certifiedinterviewer.com. That's also where you can find out more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. Who qualifies? What does it take to pass the exam? And what could it mean for your career after you pass the exam? Check it out, certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please head over to inquisive.com. That's where you can learn more about the customized engagements our clients ask us to teach their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams to help them evolve and enhance their strategic observation and persuasive communication techniques so they can encourage people to share more sensitive information in a timely manner to strengthen relationships and solve problems. It's all there at inquisive.com. Thank you all very much for taking the time to join us again today. I truly appreciate it. So now, without further ado, I introduce to you, Clint Greenleaf. Good morning, Clint. It is so great to see you again. Thank you very much for being here. How are you?
Hey, buddy, I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me. Thanks for making time.
Oh, my pleasure. You're the one making the time, man. Thank you very much. So to hit the ground running on this one, we've known each other for years. We've worked together in different capacity over the years. And one of the things I think you and I both agree on is that often CEOs don't realize how unintentionally intimidating or off-putting they can be to those around them. So if they're asking for input, questions, people to be open, they feel like they're doing everything they need to. And then they get frustrated when they see people in their organization or around them aren't opening up to the level that they would like. In different situations, I've seen you do quite well in this area. So I would love to start the conversation by asking, what have you done to help kind of thaw the barrier between yourself and your employees to encourage more of that open communication?
Well, let's start with the reality, which is I've done a lot of bad things that didn't work, which kind of informed the way that we got the way we're trying to operate now. A lot of the mistakes we used to make were based on things like, well, you know, when I started off, I was a 23-year-old CEO. I figured everybody'd be cool and we knew what we were doing. I kind of acted more like Michael Scott than I want to admit from the office, you know, like everyone's our friends and we're all doing this. And the reality is these people are intimidated because you're the CEO, because they don't recognize any sort of friendship there. They have to govern what they say. They've got to be careful how they act. And they usually are playing with a disconnect, right? And as CEO, you're like, hey, let's jump in. Let's go full bore right now. And then you feel that misconnect and you're not really sure why. So my general style is to try and be pretty open, pretty transparent, let people know that if they work really hard, I will have their back. Let people know clearly that I will praise you in public when you do something right. And if you don't do something right, I'll let you know in private so we can have that conversation. The thing is, that doesn't happen overnight, and you can't just immediately jump into that intimacy, if you will, like that moment of people understanding they trust. So it comes with a little bit of time and a little bit of effort. But in my experience, the best way to do it is to let people understand that you're a human too, that your goals are the same as theirs. And if they help you, you're going to help them, right? So that it just, you got to kind of iterate that over time.
I think it's a great answer. And kind of that difference between trust and faith. People have trust based on evidence. They have faith on, okay, I have to take your word. So all too often when we say to somebody, trust me, it's a really good reason to consider maybe I shouldn't.
That's right. That's right.
You know, over time, creating the environment to demonstrate that this is the relationship we can have. This is the type of communication. And if somebody won't put themselves in the spot for me to demonstrate that, then I've got to create the opportunity to demonstrate it so people can start to recognize it.
So my favorite thing in the world, my CFO who worked for me at my first company was awesome, great guy. And he was telling me about his, I think he'd been married for 6 months and they had to delay their honeymoon. And he was planning on canceling what they had planned because he had just started this new job. And as a human, I was like, that's stupid. Why would you do that? He's like, because I just started my job. And I was like, my God, if you show up to work and you're not in Tuscany, you're fired. And he's like, very funny. I'm like, no, I'm serious. Like, I do not want to see you. Make sure you go do this. Your family is way more important than anything that ever happens here. Go do that. What was neat was I actually meant it, right? Thank God I wasn't playing, right? And it wasn't about the trust as much as like the faith piece of him saying, holy crap. Now he's told that story so many times. I've gotten 100x the value out of that one moment because I wasn't really thinking about it in any sense other than let's be real people here. Let's do the right thing. And so to your point, if I say, trust me, I'm not a jerk. I mean, you know, my wife knows better than that. And most people, I think it's like saying, oh, honestly, well, if you're saying honestly, what's everything else you've been saying up to this point, right?
Good points. And I'm going to stay away from that hook you just gave me on the honesty, piece. But you're absolutely right. It's creating the opportunity and to do the right thing and to do it in such a clear way where there's no doubt about it. You shared a story with me a long time ago, and I think it was like post-2008, one of your previous organizations, where lots of companies were making very difficult decisions based on their employment numbers and what they had to do with their capacity on the market, so on and so forth. And unfortunately, a lot of people that you and I both knew really were in a position where they had to lay people off. And there were conversations about how they were doing that. And those are very difficult conversations. But to kind of piggyback on what you just said, you were thankfully able to, but you took a much different approach and handled that situation where you're talking about getting like 100x return just based on how you handled the conversation. If you had a minute to kind of run us through how I think you ran a lay on instead of a layoff, if I remember that term correctly, and then how that worked out for you after.
So this is clearly done pre-Me Too because lay on probably sounds creepy and you don't want to do that now. But so just to kind of paint the picture, I was in the book publishing space. We were a small kind of independent book publisher, and we were always fighting to try and get more bookstore shelf space for the promo area, right? So that's in Barnes & Noble, at Time Borders, airport bookstores. And at the time, all the big guys owned all that space. And what had happened was, the 08 crisis came through, publishers were shutting down. They were saying, we're not taking any new books. They fired most of their new editorial staffs. It was pretty easy to make this thing just go straight away, right? And what happened was I looked at our numbers and said, we have a ton of open projects. I've got to finish publishing books for at least 30 more clients. So even if I wanted to lay people off right now, I can't, right? I've got too much work that needs to be done. I'm going to go out and hire outsourced people. And these people actually know the jobs. So I'm kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. And the hard part was that even though smart money said, go ahead and do a layoff, I couldn't, right? There was just too much work to be done. And what I really needed was not, in fact, to cut expenses, but was to increase throughput. So I did a town hall meeting with the staff and I was like, look, I'm going to make a deal with everybody here, right? If it comes out of my personal pocket, I still promise every single one of you will keep your job for at least the next 6 months. Every single one of you. Now, in return, I need you to give me an extra hour a day for at least the next 3 months, maybe more than that, as long as this thing goes on. And the funny thing is, and I've learned this since from getting to know you, every single thing I said from we're having an important staff meeting with everybody there, until I said no one's losing their job for 6 months was the Peanuts parents, right? Wah, 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 wah. No one heard a damn thing that I was saying. And all they were thinking was, how does this affect me? So the first thing was, you will not have your paycheck hit by this, right? We're not cutting pay. We're not laying people off. None of that. And so you build that layer of security immediately. And luckily, I'd had enough trust that people believed me with that. And then the request to say, can you give me a little more time, was awesome, right? Like, they're fine with it. It really didn't cost them very much at all. The funny thing is, I expected really zero increased time. I didn't think anyone would give me an extra minute of time. But I wanted them not to spend that 4 hours a day working on their resumes, talking at the cooler. Are we getting fired? Should I be leaving? And you always lose your best people when there's concern about that. So I just wanted to recapture that benefit. What was really neat was we ended up getting about an extra 20 minutes a day out of every person additionally for that. We cleared up by 2 months. We were done with the entire backlog. And we told people they could stop the lay-on. Most did not, which was great. And then we promised at about 3 months, we said, we're going to promise you for the next year, everyone keeps their job. And we did that through the time we sold the company in 2011.
Fantastic story. Different approach. Now, there were some financial opportunities that allowed that. Maybe not every company would have had that opportunity.
Oh. Yeah. And let me expand on that a little bit. So the neat thing is the publishers that we were competing against did a really good job of getting scared, right? They fired a bunch of staff. They did all this. They pulled back from the bookstores. And because they didn't, we were able to now lever ourselves into airport bookstore placements, big name brand bookstores. And because of all that, we were able to get the visibility for our company, which allowed me to sell the company in 11. So it was a wonderful moment for me. And had I not done that, I wouldn't have been able to make that go.
And then capture an opportunity that came because everybody else took the opposite reaction.
That's right.
Had a conversation with somebody
else. It started with that trust. I'm sorry, but it happened because of trust and faith. And because the team had known me for long enough, they were able to believe that.
And approaching it, I know these words get thrown around so much, it makes me throw up in the back of my mouth a little bit every time I say them. But it's because of that authentic and vulnerable approach. Like, this is risky. This is a commitment. We really do care. We're going to prove it. But as part of that, here's what we're going to need on the other side. So being able to connect at that level creates the additional buy-in. And to your point, addressing that everybody is going to have their job first, now they'll listen to you. If it was, we're going to need extra time, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, people are sitting there going, you want me to do an extra hour and I might lose my job next week? Get the hell out of here.
Yep.
Because you said it first. Just yesterday, I was having a conversation with a woman who runs search and rescue teams. And one of the things she was talking about was, by the time they get called in, the cops have already been at this for 6 to 12 hours before her team get called in. Mm-hmm. So things have gone from bad to way bad. And what she has to do is come in and sit down with the families to start trying to figure out what they haven't learned already. And she just happened to say, I'm doing that while we're setting the dog teams out. Like, all right, cool. The very first thing has to be, tell them how awesome the dogs are. Right. Tell them why the dogs are out. Tell them the training the dogs have. Tell them what the dogs are looking for. Because they're scared out of their brains. They want to be out there. They're telling themselves, I need to be out there. I need to be out there. I don't want to sit on this couch. I don't want to talk to you. But as soon as they hear how great the dogs are, now they're willing to talk to you. She's like, oh, yeah. So kind of same thing. Once you address the worries or the concerns, now they're willing to open up and buy in. And even if that's a strategic move on your part, it comes across as caring about them first because we're addressing their needs before we get into our request.
And it can be both, right? Like, you can have a smart strategy behind something and not be a jerk. I think that's critical because obviously you want to be able to find the people in a SAR moment, right? And you also want to be able to get the information. There could be something that you hear in that interview that's really helpful. That's the weird part, this intersection of strategic thinking and messaging and being really clear on disciplined listening and talking and caring about people, but also then paying attention to saying, how do we do this in a way that is integrating that faith component too?
Yeah, and it can be, especially for people in your role, CEOs, running businesses, juggling chainsaws, doing all these things. If we approach a conversation based on how somebody else needs to experience it, as opposed to what we want to say, it's essentially the same message, but the results can be diametrically opposed based on the delivery. And just having that composure and foresight ahead of time makes all the difference in the world.
And I made that mistake so many times not doing that. That I think one of the neat reasons why I've enjoyed learning so much from you over the years is, wow, with a little bit of foresight, a little bit of planning, I can actually really have a dramatically better outcome for everybody, not just for me, but for the other person as well. That's kind of the firing moment, right? Where you say, look, we're going to let you go. I'm sorry, this is going to be tough. And we're going to spend a lot of time trying to help you do this, get this figured out the right way. It's not a lobby moment. It's not a change things. Here are the facts. And now how do we solve this? And how can we make this better given the reality of the moment?
Yeah. You mentioned making mistakes a couple of times. We did not talk about this ahead of time, so now I'm putting you on the spot. Do you have a funny one that sticks as like a learning anchor for you that you're comfortable sharing that has kind of propelled you forward after? I mean, starting as a 23-year-old CEO, I'm sure it's been nothing but smooth sailing.
Right. And a lot of the training I got, you know, learning from Marines how to train and lead people, you got both a carrot and the stick, right? And the stick is, of course, to beat someone over the head. And the carrot is more for like a close contact, jabbing someone in the eye. we didn't learn that much about proper motivation of people. And the way that you can talk to a 22-year-old infantry corporal is very different than the way you should probably talk to a 45-year-old assistant. And saying things like, what the actual hell are you doing? Are you purposely stupid? Are you trying to bankrupt the company? Things that I didn't think were really that meaningful, and understanding how impactfully damaging it can be, right? Like where I think I'm either being maybe a little kitschy, a little bit funny, but really, really hurtful to people. I have talked to a lot of the early employees that we've had over the years and apologize immensely for saying I didn't know what I didn't know and I was such a jerk, right? So I wish it was more Michael Scott, but sometimes it was just drill instructor Clint coming out, which really was not helpful to anybody. I wasn't even a good drill instructor, right? I just thought I was kind of a tough guy. I thought leadership means that you've got to be able to yell at your troops. Over time, that has come with a lot of experience. And thankfully, some of the people were really good at saying, hey, you're kind of unnecessarily an ass right now. Like, are you trying to come across this way? Or is there a different way you could say that? You know, instead of shut your mouth, maybe like, hey, maybe you could say, can you think a little more about this issue before we have a clear discussion on it? And that, I think, comes through experience. Also, not being the sharpest knife in the drawer, it's a little bit harder for me to learn some of these lessons. But great people helped coach me through the way. Would have been great if you were there, you know, when I was first 22, 23, getting started. But you were busy, apparently. I don't know.
Oh, when you were 23, getting started, I was probably also 22, 23, making some different decisions at the time. So I don't know that I would have been able to help you at that point. It likely would have been pouring gasoline over an open flame. But we're here now.
That's right. Now we're such wonderfully intelligent and skilled leaders, right?
We've made it this far. Honestly, the way I learned was if you just keep touching the electric fence, eventually it will change your brainwaves. You'll figure something else along.
This one time it's not going to burn as much, right?
Yeah. You mentioned great people that helped you along the way. We initially met through YPO, where you have a network, you and all the other members have a network of successful CEOs who are dedicated to continuing education and supporting and developing each other and solving the problems that you run into as you operate your organizations. We talked a little bit in the beginning of the conversation about lowering the barriers between ourselves and our employees. Once you get to that CEO to CEO conversation, on occasion, I've seen some egos come into play in some
what
of
what you're talking about. This
it's just one of these things I've bumped into once in a while, and people who wanted to defend a hill that might not be worth defending or push an idea that probably worked for them, but might not work in this other area. So if we kind of turn the dial a little bit, and by the way, I've seen tons of great conversations in that arena as well. Don't want to sound like that I'm mowing over everybody here, but as we change the conversation to that arena, how have you learned? Like, it'll be a two-part question. I'll do this one at a time. How have you learned to let down your guard and put your ego in your back pocket to help learn from other people's experiences?
So I think I got there the wrong way, but it worked out really well for me. I was surrounded. My first forum in YPO was a great group of people. There were a couple entrepreneurs. One was launching an IPO, some family business people, And some people had just been at it for a very long time. And the chemistry and the makeup of that group was really, really good. So when we were going through a sale process, I had people who I knew were smarter than I was, who had been there before and had done it on a much bigger scale. I was a rounding error. My entire deal volume size was a rounding error for one of these guys who was doing the IPO. And so it was pretty easy to put my ego in check and say, I'm going to learn from you on this. What was really neat was we had a guy who was a family business guy. And I've generally unfairly characterized most second, third generation family business people as this lucky guy, right? The lucky kid whose dad did all the work and they've just kind of shown up and done this. And there was a cartoon, you're probably too young for this, but when I was a kid, Inspector Gadget was-
Don't insult me like that. In fact, my son watches Inspector Gadget with me now.
Yes, awesome. Yeah, I knew Gabe was a smart kid. So here's what I can tell you. Remember Inspector Gadget, bumbling idiot, right? And Penny and the Brain, his niece and the dog, were awesome. And they saved him from everything. And they made him be the hero and made it look that way. What I learned was sometimes in family businesses, generation two or three are Penny and the Brain solving all the problems and letting dad or grandpa look the part. And it was a really cool moment for me because I didn't go in expecting that. And I kind of figured I don't need to listen to what these guys have to say. I can discount that because there's an ego moment to it. But because I was in this relatively safe space where people can say, hey, I don't think that's a good idea. We need to make sure you pay attention to this. I was able to learn more from them. So when I was selling my business, I thought, hey, I'm just going to go ahead and make sure that my staff understands this. And people pulled me aside and said, that's a terrible idea. You need to message this properly to your staff. So start with the core group who's working with the investment makers and the buyers and do all that. And then separately, let's plan out the conversation with your staff. And they gave me kind of a framework for it, which was awesome. Thank God I listened to it. And it, to your point before, right? It started with, we've sold the company. So here's a fact, right? And then everyone's keeping their jobs. And you let about 0 second pause between we sold the company and everyone keeps their jobs. And we had a chance to sell to a strategic. We didn't because they would have fired everybody. And so I left a little bit of money on the table in order to do that, to keep everyone's jobs. When I asked people if I gave them big enough severance, how long of a severance would it have to be for them to be okay with selling to a strategic? About half of them said, I don't want that. I just want to keep my job. Like 2 years? No, I don't want that. I just want to keep my job, which is crazy to me, right? Because you can get another job in 2 years' time. But the messaging was so clear and they were so good at helping me understand that. I was able to test it in real time almost immediately after joining. So very quickly, I bought into the value of YPO. Very quickly, it made sense to me to say, wow, although I've gotten a couple check marks on my success list, there are people who know so much more than I do, and I cannot wait to learn from them. So it's been lucky for me to be able to see that. And I think usually there's that quick win of YPO where pretty early on, you find a connection, a person, a friend who helps you see that. And most of us who've been in for a while have had that happen.
Great example. The follow-up question to that is, with your extended time in the organization and seeing so many people come through and be a part of so many different events and groups, multiple states and beyond, how have you seen, I was going to ask two questions at once again. How have you seen, I'm going to do this one more time. People can laugh as I'm the guy that's supposed to be able to ask questions. And here I am stumbling over three in a row.
Everyone listening needs to know, this is one of the reasons why he's so damn disarming, right? Because he's being honest and he's telling you what he's thinking. And so you're like, oh, no, that's fine. This happens over time because it's a normal conversation. He's building trust right before he gets the gotcha moment. So go ahead.
So here comes the gotcha, which unfortunately for this conversation isn't a gotcha, because that would be fun for me. This is recorded and I wouldn't do that to you. What are the most successful techniques you've seen for influencing CEOs and business owners, people who generally have higher opinions of themselves, have the success to back it up, might be a little bit more defensive, but when you've seen breakthrough moments in these conversations, what have been the techniques that typically bring those out?
Yeah, that's really good. You have to know the person well, right? Is this a lifelong learner who is perfectly willing to question everything and say, well, I didn't know that. That's really cool. Or is this someone who's believes that they're there because of their own experience, brilliance, and does not have any interest in learning new things? And you can still teach both of those people, right? But you've got to figure out the motivation. So if one of them is a lifelong learner who wants to learn new things, it's pretty easy to sprinkle in and be like, hey, just so you know, there's kind of an interesting thought you may want to consider over here. For the other guy or gal, you've got to figure out what their motivation is, right? And so they think they're the smartest person in the room. Is it because they're secretly insecure and they don't want to look insecure? In which case, you've got to somehow pacify or mollify that, right? Is it that they believe that they've gotten there only through hard work and brilliance and their own hard work, and accepting anyone else's beliefs will somehow cheapen their own model? You kind of have to figure out what's your angle in, and it's very rarely the front door. If they're pigheaded or bullish or strong, saying, hey, you're stupid, rarely works. I've got a really, really wonderful redheaded Irish attorney wife. I love her very much. And in my experience, when I'm trying to convince Kate of something, it's never by punching her in the face and saying, you're wrong and here's why. Let me show you exactly why you're crazy on this. There are better ways to do that. And I think you kind of have to know the person. So if you're trying to influence someone who's pretty strong, figure out what their motivation is, what their like fifth level motivation, right? And it may be insecurity, it could be wealth, it could be whatever. But when you figure that one out and you speak to that fifth level of motivators, it's much easier to figure out how to get them back to it. And it's less about challenging and saying you're wrong. And it's more about saying, let me help you solve for that insecurity. Let me help you solve for the wealth issue. And I have an idea. It's kind of crazy, and feel free to throw it out, but you might want to hear about it. And it becomes less of an attack and much more of a clear understanding that I'm actually trying to help you get there. Don't stand in my way while I do this.
I love all of that. Quick question before I forget to ask. Do you mind diving into what you mean by fifth level motivator?
Yeah. So if my first level motivator, and fifth is kind of a made up number, right? But at the core level, right? If you say, Clint, why do you run a business? And I say, because I like to help people. And you say, oh, okay, that's kind of a BS answer, right? Like, what do you really want to do? Well, I like to create new ideas and help foster podcasts and books. Okay, why, right? And as we go down that list, eventually I'm going to say, because freedom is so important to me that I want everyone to have the freedom to share their ideas, right? So if freedom is my core motivator, maybe it's five layers down, but you might have to peel back that onion a couple different times to get to that core moment. And usually it's a fifth level, right? No one's going to tell you because I really want to make money. Well, why, right? Like you think you want wealth. Well, you want freedom. You want whatever the core element is. And you'll eventually get down there. You might need to spend some time getting to know the person and building a rapport and figuring out what their real core motivators are. And so I think it takes a while to get to that. And just jumping right in, you know, you can't usually close a deal on a first date, and nor should you try to.
Thank you for explaining that. So many key things that you hit on there. Three of the top elements I really believe in the influence process in general, but especially people with higher egos or stakes driven deeper into the ground or a bigger hill to defend, however you want to say it. Number one is timing. How often at any point in life are we successful if we say, oh, that advice that you didn't ask for but popped into my head right now, here it is. Like that very often is only going to make things worse. So trying to find the right time for it. My wife recently handled the situation brilliantly and in an unexpected moment where she had some communication. She needed some other executives to hear. She's a chief human resources officer and thankfully was thinking long-term and didn't give it as soon as it jumped into her mind, even though it was a great point and a strong, rational, factual disagreement to something that was being offered. But later on a call with a vendor, had the opportunity with all the stakeholders on the call, had the opportunity to answer a vendor's question with all the information she needed the other people to know. So that way at the end of the call, they could be like, oh, wow, Brooke, I'm really glad you mentioned that. We weren't aware. Now we're going to make a different decision. So finding the timing is number one. Number two is helping people save face. And especially the higher the ego, the higher the visibility, the greater the audience, helping people save face. That's not just an Eastern culture thing. That's not just a child thing. That is a human being thing. And the third one you mentioned when you brought up the freedom is build it around outcomes. It's not, I think you should do. Right. It's understanding this is where we're trying to go. This is where you're trying to go. This is where you're trying to get the organization. Working backwards. So now it's not me versus you. My idea is better than your idea. It's understanding the outcome correctly an alternative route to get you there. So timed right, save face, frame about outcomes, which you just illustrated, generally helps get us there.
Right. And so going back to like a first month or so of a new employee at the company, I want to find out what their long game is, right? For me, it's sitting on a rocking chair when I'm 85 with no regrets, right? I want to be able to look out at the sunset, family around, and not have a regret of I didn't do something important. And so everything I do is driven around that goal. And it's kind of that's my North Star, right? And I want to know what other people's are. And if someone's life goal is to have a camp for type 1 diabetic kids who just found out and have no idea how to deal with this, cool. That's great. Like I can help you get to that goal and we can help build that plan. Finding out what the big long-term goals are and then the short-term things, right? Like, oh, I love waking up every day and having a Diet Pepsi. I don't know who drinks Diet Pepsi, but let's say someone does, right? We actually bought Diet Pepsi and had it in the office fridge just for one employee who wanted to have a Diet Pepsi every morning. That was their thing. And little things like that build that trust and that friendship over time. So you can later on say, hey, I do think we need to be able to have this conversation. And it does further the long game goal of the type 1 diabetic camp. And you do have your needs met or your wants met by having this Diet Pepsi. But here's what I need you to be able to do. And it works on a high level too, where you kind of build that trust, but you're also focused on their ultimate goal or that fifth level.
Again, I love it. I'm going to have to come up with a way to contradict something you say eventually.
I'm surprised you haven't. This is, I feel kind of dirty. You've been way too nice to me.
You know, it's one of those days. I just feel like being nice. But working towards achieving our goal and helping somebody else achieve their goal, they don't have to be the same goal. The path can be the same road for a significant amount of the journey until it diverges. And just because it diverges doesn't mean it doesn't cross again. So if we can look at it as, at some point, I'm going to have a difficult ask of somebody. At some point, I'm going to have a difficult conversation with somebody. At some point, I'm going to have a challenge I'm going to work through with somebody. That's just part of doing business. It's the world we live in. So over time, if I can learn what's important to them, and if it is Pepsi, or if it is an extra day off to go watch their kid play soccer, if it is whatever, all those little things help build the trust equity necessary to productively navigate the inevitable challenge, which will get us both closer to achieving our goals, which kind of gets back to the foresight and things we were talking about earlier.
Well, and discipline listening, right? Like if I didn't write it down in a book, I never would have remembered the Diet Pepsi, right? So after every conversation, and I'm kind of old school, not really an Evernote guy. I'm more just a piece of papers or a little booklet, but I want to write down what's important. And I had a list for everybody, right? And I guess it would have been probably creepy for people to know, but it was important to know that Katie really cared about these six things. And if she saw that book, she'd be like, yeah, that's probably legit. That's right. That makes sense, right? And if you listen and you keep track of things and you pay attention, it's a lot easier to help that path. And like you said, yeah, there's times where someone says, I've given you 3 great years and I'm going to go off and follow my passion and do something different. Cool. Great. Thanks. Doesn't mean it's not a difficult conversation. Doesn't mean there's not a problem with it. But hopefully you have a relationship with both and hopefully you can help them along the way. And like you said, coming back, that does happen from time to time.
I know we're pressed for time a little bit this morning, and I've got about 4 hours of questions I would love to ask you. So maybe I can trick you into coming back. But you've taken the time to be here. I want to talk a little bit about your business as well, because you are in the communication business, and this is a communication conversation. So you mentioned earlier giving people the opportunity to launch their book or launch their podcast or otherwise share their ideas. If you could, you know, 30 seconds or less, let us know what your business is so people who are listening hear it directly from you instead of my potentially lousy introduction. But then also, as you look at helping people share their ideas across different mediums, what do you believe makes a great communicator across these different, I'll use the word again, mediums?
Yep. Let me answer the second part of that first because it's really important. I think you genuinely have to give a damn about the audience to whom you're communicating, right? So if you are speaking for your own edification, just stop. If you've written a book about how great you are, probably stop, right? There's like 30 people in the world who you want to read those books about. Most people are not the ones. As far as the mediums themselves, I'm kind of medium agnostic. My first company was a book company. That was literally the name of it. Greenleaf Book Group was in the name. And we did books. And so if you came to me with a great idea for an online course or a podcast or anything else, I'd find a way to create a book for you, why the hell was I doing that? It didn't make any sense, right? So books are a valuable tool in some cases. In other cases, it's a podcast. And the people that read your book are different than people who listen to your podcast in many cases, right? And when they come pay you to come speak at a large event, that's different too. And so the message you give is going to be different per medium. And the way that people consume it is different. What we do is we help people hone their message and then use content to further their ultimate business goal. So for you, if you want to help people become better listeners and better communicators, awesome. A book is a great part of that. But also, they should probably see you talk. They should probably see you on a video podcast, hear you talk. They should probably be able to see you in person and learn. I mean, sitting literally knee to knee with you, watching an interrogation tactic, I didn't even do anything and I was still nervous about it. But it was a really good moment. Now that I've got three teenage kids, it's really helpful for me to be able to know exactly how to sit across from them. I think sharing that message, the core message somebody has, their brilliance, their expertise, their passion, but also really their talent more than just passion, sharing that with the world in the best possible way is something that I really enjoy. I've been lucky enough to be able to share my message. I love teaching kids about money. It's a big deal for me. I want to have fewer entitled monsters and more financially savvy kids, right? So sharing that message makes me quite happy. And I know that it furthers my ultimate goal. And if I can help other people do that, seeing the joy it brings other people and also the value it brings them for their business and for me is an awesome deal.
I'm not going to let you off the hook for the first part of the question, but I'm going to ask a follow-up here before.
Yeah, I forget. What was the first part? Because I will answer. I just forget what it was.
It was about your company, but we'll get to that in a second.
Oh, yeah,
now
yeah.
I have a question that I have limited brain capacity to remember before I forget to ask. You mentioned talent and passion. If you have a talent and you have a passion and you want to share it and that's important to you, then do it. Talent and passion, in my experience, can be a double-edged sword. One person's talent and passion can be perceived by some to be just that. This is valuable. They care. This is important to them. To others, it can be obnoxious and it can be off-putting and it can be perceived to be selfish. And there's no doubt that people have perceived me to be on either sides of that sword at different periods of time in different scenarios. So as people present their ideas to you, whether it's a book, whether it's a podcast, whether it's an online training course, and you're going through that process with them, how do you help people channel their talent and passion into productive educational communication and help them steer away from being perceived as the jerk or the ego guy, or the person who loves to hear himself talk?
So that's a good question. We are really, really selective on the people with whom we work. So I'm really good at saying, I don't think we're the right shop for you. We're probably not niched in this area. Even if it's something really specific that I probably know well, if the client isn't the right client for us, we're very quick to say, thanks, not a good fit. But I want to know that content, if you told me, for example, you want to do a book about Boston sports and how great Boston sports are, nobody cares. No one thinks Boston sports are good at all. So no one's going to buy this book. I understand the logic of this, but let's go back to 90s me when you guys weren't that good at anything, right?
I remember those days. Wow.
If you go to a book that's a passion project that isn't really going to further anyone's goals, you're not going to sell 20 million copies and you're not going to have a podcast that's going to have Warby Parker ads and Athletic Greens on there. So if you're not going to do that, what's the ultimate goal? Well, if the ultimate goal is just to tell people how great Boston sports are, probably not worth making a big push on it. Now, some people who are really passionate about it, they can self-publish that book. They can put it out on Amazon and make it, you know, still tell their story and be passionate about it. But we like to work with people where that intersection of passion and talent fits with a business goal as well. So a lot of cases, I get the privilege of telling people, I don't think we're a good fit for you. And that's a lot of the projects we work with. That's a privilege, by the way, that comes from years and years of publishing anything that came through the pipe. And we've gotten lucky enough now that we don't need to do that. But the hard part really is when someone says, I want to change the world because I believe that botany is the secret to happiness and everyone should have plants in their house and everyone should become a gardener. Well, I'm not sure that's actually going to happen, right? So your ultimate dream goal is never going to be able to be achieved through a book or a podcast or anything else. How do we help you find a different goal for it? And if I can't help you do that, you should write your book and best of luck.
Like all of that, there's a little guy on my team. So I coach youth baseball. There's a 5-year-old kid on my team whose parents are from Cleveland. So he's always showing up in, we'll say, Guardians gear, I guess.
We will not say Guardians. Still the Indians.
Thank you. And the other day, he got a big hit, stretched it into a double. When he came back, I gave him a high five. I'm like, dude, how to hustle Kenny Lofton? He looks at me and goes, who's Kenny Lofton? I'm like, sit down. We got to talk.
Kids got to learn their history, man.
But back to why we're here. If you're presented an idea, is there a formula or a judgment or a process you go through to determine book, podcast, online training, best avenue to pursue an idea?
Yes, sort of, right? I want to know who the core audience is. So if we get down to that core level goal, which is I want to sell more widgets for my widget company. Okay, cool. Your widget consumers, are they going to be benefited by a book, a podcast, whatever? And if they're all, let's say your widget is knitting needles, right? And so you know you own the 80 plus market. So a 91-year-old grandma is going to definitely buy your knitting needles. Cool. Online course, probably not going to be a thing. YouTube videos, probably not. Podcasts, probably not. A magazine? Interesting, maybe. A book, quite possibly, but probably a large print book and probably with some photographs and probably somehow weaving this together. What are the components of hitting that core audience? Now, if the book instead is to try and get big box stores like Hobby Lobby or Michaels to carry it, well, then we probably don't want to do a book because you're looking for two different buyers, two people in the world to do it. Why don't you do a podcast and interview both of the buyers from Michaels and talk about why your knitting needles are so great? And now you've had that personal conversation. And if instead you want to convince 20-year-olds to do it, you probably want to kill YouTube and go crazy with YouTube videos about how to knit and probably have an online course that isn't that expensive. And then maybe you advertise the course to grandma or great-grandma so she buys it for her 20-year-old great-grandkid. So it's really about who's your audience in that model and what's your business goal. And they kind of intersect with what's good. There are people like you and me who have faces for radio. We should probably not be on video. I hope people are only listening to us. But for those that are actually watching, I apologize on both of our behalfs. Some people should be very visual and very visible, and other people maybe not as much.
Thank you for taking my self-esteem down another couple pegs, but at least we went together. So I'm good with that.
That's skilled communication right there, by the way.
It is.
Also moral honesty, which is the other benefit there.
The more vulnerable you can be, the more people will talk to you, right? I really want to thank you for your time. I know you got another meeting backed right up to this, and I appreciate you making the time for this conversation. Before we go, I also want to thank you. I know we've been a part of a lot of projects and a lot of things over time, but once upon a time, several lifetimes ago, the phrase disciplined listening was the answer to a question I was asked in a training course. Somebody about 7 minutes later got about 4 centimeters away from my nose without warning me to explain to me how that was going to become the title of everything that we would eventually do. And then lo and behold, it got done. And none of this would have happened without your support, your belief, your encouragement, all of those things. So I know you talked about having the privilege of telling people no. I appreciate you lowering the bar just a little bit for me and all of the support that you've shown me over the years. It's been great to get your perspective out here for others, and hopefully we can dive in a little bit deeper at another time down the road. So keep doing such great work, helping people get their freedom to their ideas and their passion out, because the ripple effects of how many people are being helped and improved and educated by that are substantial. So thank you.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it. And again, with my 3 kids will tell you that my ability to listen and in a disciplined way, obviously, has gotten so much better. And luckily I've got 3 kids with whom I've got great relationships. I think because I've learned to listen and hear what they have to say before I think of the next thing to say. And it does take discipline, and I really appreciate all you've done for me. So thank you, pal.
I appreciate it, man. Stay safe out there. Good luck with the rest of your day today. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, buddy. See you soon.
Clint, thank you so much for a great conversation. I really appreciate you sharing your time. Thank you for being so open and honest about things that worked well for you, things that didn't work so well for you, and all the lessons in between. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you. So much to go back and reflect on, but really, I would love to highlight your passion for helping people reach their goals and for giving people the opportunity to embrace the freedom that we have to share our ideas with the world. Thank you so much for that. And the way that you talk about the importance of understanding, listening to, addressing, and connecting with your audience as well is all very important for all of us to remember, especially me. So thank you very much. I truly appreciate that. And thank you to everyone who listened to this conversation. I appreciate you being there. Hopefully you enjoyed learning from Clint's experiences as much as I did. Thank you for being here once again and listening to another conversation. Before we go, we want to make sure we thank our sponsors. Let's start with HumanTel. Please head over to humantel.com and enter the code INCUASIVE25 for 25% off of their best-in-class online training to identify when people's emotions are likely changing and what they're probably thinking and feeling in the moment by recognizing shifts in somebody's facial expressions and nonverbal behavior. I've completed their training myself. I highly recommend it. Head over to humantel.com and enter the code INCUASIVE25. For the professional interviewers, please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn about all of the educational resources and opportunities, networking resources and opportunities, legal updates, all you can want to know about the professional interviewing industry over at certifiedinterviewer.com. That's also where you can learn about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. Who qualifies? What does it take to pass and maintain the designation? And what can it mean for your career after? All of that and more at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please head over to INCUASIVE.com. That's where you can learn more about the customized programs our clients ask us to facilitate to their senior leaders, HR teams, and sales teams to teach them the strategic observation and persuasive communication techniques necessary to obtain the everyday confessions, get to truth faster, with less resistance, and create commitment over compliance to solve our communication problems faster. You can find all of that and more over at INCUASIVE.com. Thank you all very much for taking the time to be here today and listen to another episode. We truly appreciate it. Before you go, please like the show, share the show, subscribe to the show, tell your friends about it, and leave us your feedback. What would you like to hear more or less of? What can we deliver more for you? Please let us know. Thank you all again. Take care, stay safe, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.